Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and with us today is Caitlin Fitzgerald, who is the author of a new book called The Children's Illustrated Classfits. And we're going to be talking about that book today. We're going to talk a little bit about Classfits. We're going to talk about the path to publication that this book took, and really just how fascinating this whole idea is. And so how are you doing today, Caitlin?
I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
I am doing pretty well. It's starting to get a little bit chillier here in Lexington, but that's just fine with me.
Oh, that's fair. Best time of year.
Yeah, no, fall is the best time. Exactly. So, I mean, I know part of the story, but I don't know all of it. So why don't you, can we start with the question, how did this idea become an idea and how did it start moving in a direction?
Sure. It was about 10 years ago and it was just a chat on Twitter with some people, and a friend mentioned that he had been reading On War for him, it was probably the fifth or sixth time he was reading it. And his five-year-old son wanted to look at the book and then looked at it and said, "But Daddy, it doesn't have any pictures." And then another friend made a comment like, "Oh, wow, a children's illustrated Clausewitz would be awesome." And I thought about it, and I had just read it for the first time myself, and I thought, I could do that. So from there, I just started a couple months later, I started making it. I put it up on a blog and just posted my progress as I went and just started, reading the book piece by piece and trying to boil it down to sort of simpler language. So, the aim was smart 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I was going for. And then illustrating it as I went.
Right. And so the entire project, I mean, so when from you, when you started really thinking about this, that this is a book that's going to happen to actually completing the book, how long did that process take apart from sort of the initial sketching?
I mean, like I said, I started working on the project about 10 years ago. I didn't at the time ever imagine that it would be a book. I just thought it was a fun blog project I was going to do and that, maybe I'd finish it, maybe I wouldn't. I never really conceived of it as a book until I started getting approached by people genuinely offering to publish it. Mm-hmm. So there were stops and starts. I mean, there was a point where I didn't work on it for a few years before it got revived again about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I had another publisher in the past where the publisher ended up going under before the book could get around to being made. And it was after that, I think it was probably 2 or 3 years before I even looked at it again.
Right. And so you ended up going with Unbound, right? Which was,
No, it's through, Helios House.
Oh, Helios. That's right.
Small publisher. Yeah. They're, the Nick Jensen Jones who runs Helios House is another person I've known on Twitter for many years who is worked in think tanks in Australia and does a lot of armaments research and that sort of thing. And he was just starting up this little boutique publishing operation and approached me saying, "Hey, whatever happened to that Children's Illustrated Clausewitz you're working on? Like, did anything ever go anywhere with that?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, what would you think about doing a Kickstarter and publishing it?" And I said, "Sure." So that's how it got revived.
Right, right. And I mean, I have it right here. It's a beautiful, absolutely just without sort of starting to go into what's in the book, it's an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous volume. So you used to do, organize a lot of the Twitter Fight Club stuff. And so you must have lots of people who are Classfits aficionados, are, people who've been through the PME system where people do Classfits every year. Did you ever run into issues where people had conflicting interpretations of Classfits because teaching Classfits among other practitioners, sometimes people will be in vicious disputes about what Classfits meant at any particular part in the text.
I'm sure. I've tried to stay out of that side of it, honestly. When I first started working on it, I went out and bought a bunch of the sort of Clausewitz interpretations, and I was going to read a lot of the commentary on it. And then I realized that I would just bog myself down with it, and that I kind of just had to go ahead and interpret it however I was going to interpret it and let people deal with it as they would. So I really have not involved myself in any of the sort of interpretation debates. I just put my own take in there. And I figure I'm sure people will have their disagreements with the way I interpreted things, and that's fine.
Yeah, I remember reading last year a book that was all just about the different editions of CLASFITs. Like I think my Hugh Strahan's book on, this is how we interpret CLASFITs at different times with different translations. But you used the parrot primarily, or was it conjunction?
I tried to refer to a few different ones. So I had like the Gram, I had the parrot, I had, for every section that I did, I would look at it at a couple of different translations just to see if it struck me differently in different versions, or if some seemed to work better for me than others. So I tried not to stick to one translation. I tried to spread it out a little bit there.
So can you tell me a little bit about, and one of the favorite things I liked about this was the final chapter, which is sort of a making of chapter. Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach the illustration part of it, and especially things like perspective and, it's a dialogue in a lot of ways, right? It's a dialogue between Herr Clausewitz and this class of, educated, smart 10-year-olds who are presumably listening to him. But could you tell us a little bit about how you did the artwork and the sketching?
Sure. I came to the framing device pretty early on of setting it as like a classroom in the Prussian forest. And then I have 9 children in the class just because I always like the number 9. And I used animals that are native to Prussia, where Clausewitz was from. And decided to for the interest of the illustrations to keep it mixed up to show not just the classroom, but also what their perspectives are on what they're learning in the class. So I tried to give each student at least like a single, a set perspective, a different way of looking at things, so that they would each have a different style. And then most of the illustrations, I start with very, very rough sketches of just what I want to do. And then from there, I do like a more fleshed out pencil drawing, and then ink, and then most of the color is added with watercolor. There are some exceptions, especially the character of Martin. The whole perspective of Martin is just that whatever she's seeing has nothing to do with what they're talking about. She's in her own world. So with those are a little different. Sometimes it's marker, sometimes it's paper collage, sometimes it's, digital. So that was kind of the area for the most movement, but most of it is pencil, then ink, then watercolor.
Now, my sense was that you have a pretty good grip on the kinds of questions that kids this age were going to be asking about this particular thing, especially active ones. I mean, how did you come to that perspective? Like, did you have 10-year-olds you tried to run this by, or?
No, I mean, I've worked with kids a lot. I've had a lot of, I don't have kids of my own, but I have nieces and a lot of my friends have kids. I used to be a preschool teacher. I've worked, in after-school programs. I've worked with just about every age group over the course of my life. So I have a pretty good handle on the way kids think, I think. And a lot of it was really just looking at like, if I'm putting this word in here, is a kid going to know what this word means? And interjecting questions from the kids in the class whenever I came across, a vocabulary word or a concept that seemed a little too sticky to just leave on its own.
Right. Have you tried to run it past some actual 10-year-olds and see like what they did? Did you have a test group that just, they read it and hopefully it makes sense to them? I have my own 12-year-olds that I have not had read this yet. And so I'm anticipating forcing it upon them. So.
Yeah, I didn't yet. I mean, I'm looking forward to hearing what some of the kids I know think. There are some kids in my, family and extended friends group that I hope will read it and let me know, how much they can understand it. But, the main audience for it is adults. It's people who have had to read Clausewitz or who enjoy reading Clausewitz. And, much as I'm tickled by the idea that people are going to read this with their kids, I think the primary audience was always more adults.
I mean, I enjoy reading Clausewitz, but even I don't enjoy reading Clausewitz. So, in professional settings, it does strike me. So what have you, from that audience, what have you heard? So I guess another way of framing this is that in professional military education sectors, even at the very graduate level at the War College and so forth, Clausewitz is an intensely difficult text, and there are lots of differences. And so have you had people reach out to you or any reception from colonels and lieutenant colonels who are going to be subjected to Clausewitz or who are currently being subjected, who are taking this as like, this is going to be a good summary of the work?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know to what degree, you know, people are joking or serious, but even from the very start, when I first, you know, my first post about this project 10 years ago, I got, you know, dozens of emails within the first few days, most of them from people at, you know, the military academies or the postgraduate schools talking about like, oh, I need something like this for my students, or people who had studied there saying, I wish I had had this when I was in school and had to study Clausewitz. It's something I've heard then, and I'm still hearing now. We actually had one person reach out to the publisher asking if he could buy enough copies for his whole Marine unit. So, you know, I don't know to what degree any of these people are serious about it, but it's definitely something that has come up plenty.
I mean, I can say having taught it in undergraduate, graduate, and professional military contexts, that a lot of what you say here would I think assist understanding on the part of the people who are reading it, right? So I think it would be a really valuable resource for a lot of those folks who are either returning Clausewitz or who are attacking it for the first time. And I use attacking there, you know, quite intentionally in the terms that Clausewitz might ask for. You know, during this process, and really during any process where one is essentially writing what in a way is a translation, right? I mean, you're writing a translation of an English version of Clausewitz for a different audience who doesn't necessarily speak the language that Clausewitz is writing in, right? So he's being translated from the German. You're translating from the English into a language, a visual and a written language, which is understandable by a different kind of audience. Did you feel yourself sort of getting a sense of who he was? Did you feel like a sort of developing a connection and an understanding of his text? Because, you mean, I'm sure you're aware of the sort of the really interesting work that's being done on his relationship with his wife and her role as an editor of his work and progenitor of his work. So did you feel like you really got to know old man Carl in putting this together?
I mean, a little bit. I wouldn't say intensely, and I do think that you know, the work that's being done about the relationship with his wife is really interesting, and how much of a role she might have played in what we actually see of his work. I think that's a really interesting question. But yeah, I mean, I think biggest takeaway from it, and this is probably in part just the modern context that, like, I'm doing this in the middle of our, you know, eternal war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that so much of what he is saying is essentially that you shouldn't go into war unless you know what you're going in there for. That, you know, a lot of what he's talking about, at least especially in these early chapters or the early books of it, boils down to, you know, when you go into a war, you should have an outcome. You should know what outcome you're looking for and what you're willing to do to reach that outcome. And then you do that. And it's so alien to how we have been conducting these wars here over the last few decades. And that just like that, I feel like, is the theme that had just kept striking me over and over again as I was doing this.
All right. That there are, well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because if the, you know, you say it's a text for adults, right? And adults are going to be reading it. Maybe kids will. But a lot of kids, I mean, my kids were born in 2009, so they don't know anything but this sort of forever war in Afghanistan and this sort of semi-forever war in Afghanistan. And so sort of taking those lessons to heart are it's going to be an interesting, it's sort of an interesting thing reading Clausewitz in the context of some wars that seem to violate every Clausewitzian prescript about how the nation ought to go about waging war.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the contrast was, you know, very noticeable.
Right. So this is volume one, right? So is there a volume two?
We're talking about it. There might be. It's a lot of work.
Right.
So it's been kind of nice. I mean, for probably about a year there, I couldn't really work on any other major art projects. And I always have other projects going. So it was a long time to not be able to do anything but this one project. So I'm kind of enjoying having a little more time to work on other things right now. But the response has been really great. You know, the Kickstarter went well. We've pretty much sold through all of the first printing. We're getting ready to do a second printing. So it seems like the appetite might be there for the volume two. And I think I would just do one more volume that would cover the rest of On War. So hopefully maybe in a year or two.
So the critical response has been enthusiastic so far. People have really enjoyed the book, or?
Yeah. I mean, if people are not enjoying it, I haven't really heard it, which is fine with me. You know, I've read one review who didn't like my art, which, you know, that's fine. Not for everybody, but yeah, I mean, so far people have been really, really, you know, lovely about it.
Right. Would you ever consider, I mean, my request would be, and this of course would be extremely demanding in and of itself, would be for a children's illustrated Thucydides. Because that's the other really big piece.
The other tough text. One to get through.
Yeah, I think it's in some ways it's a less demanding text than Clausewitz, and perhaps one because you can always have. You know, I think that Larry Gonick essentially he did the Peloponnesian War in one of his sort of cartoon history of the world volumes, but
yeah.
Still, that wasn't quite an illustrated Thucydides, right? And so that might be really fun for an audience that has already been primed by Assassin's Creed to think about the Peloponnesian War. But that might be a fun one.
That I'll add it to the list.
down the road, a short book, a small project for the future, right? When you have a spare decade to work on it,
I'm sure. A small, minor little volume, yeah.
Right, exactly. So we have some extra time here, and so I wanted to go back. I mean, you and I became acquainted. I knew about I followed the blog from fairly early on, I think. And I knew you through Twitter Fight Club. How did you become involved in sort of this, like the national security Twitter sphere, the sort of general national security blogosphere? How did this come to interest you?
Honestly, through Twitter, it was probably through the Iran elections in 2009 when there were, you know, the extensive protests there. That was, I think, the first time that I saw the utility of Twitter as a you know, an immediate news source as well as a sort of community source. And that I started, you know, following, spending more time on Twitter, things like that, and met a few people through that. I was, you know, I did a degree in international relations. I was always interested in international relations and politics and history. You know, I just started meeting people, and I think you probably know from, especially from those early days of Twitter, like one person leads to another. And
right.
It was really a community then. So, you know, getting to know people. And then Twitter Fight Club started as a joke, as as a lot of these projects seem to do. That was, I want to say it was Chris Albin who did it at first, like on a lark in March one year, did a March Madness bracket, not intending to actually have a tournament, but just as a funny joke, haha, here's a March Madness bracket of, you know, national security, foreign policy, Twitter. And then there were, you know, maybe four or five of us that he sent it to who were like, it would be kind of fun if we actually did that though, right? and I ended up being the sort of one running it because I was less... I didn't care as much about participating, and it felt like whoever was doing the administrating shouldn't be a contestant in it as well. So the other folks were kind of more interested in competing in it. So I ended up being the administrator, and then it went from there.
Right. I remember going from 1 year being offended that I was excluded to, you know, participating as vigorously as I could the second and third year. And then by like the fourth year, it's like, oh my God, this is just exhausting, right? It's exhausting to be a participant, right? I can't even imagine how exhausting it must have been to be one of the people who ran it.
I mean, it was genuinely like having an extra full-time job for a few weeks every spring. That's how much time it took between, you know, getting people to judge and putting up and taking down the polls and putting all the judgments together and doing all the posts at the end of it. It did turn into a pretty full-time, you know, it was probably a good 30, 40 hours a week of work for like 3 weeks, but it was a lot of fun for while it lasted. I don't think it would be doable now for many, many reasons, but,
what are some of the reasons besides the 34 hour work week?
I think that the structure of Twitter is very different. Like the way the features have changed on Twitter over the years makes it less conducive to this kind of thing. I think that, It's just larger. There's just so many people out there that it's not as much of a focused community that it was at this time. And it got meaner. Like, people got meaner. It was, you know, really meant to be all in good fun. And I think the last year we had it, not the contestants themselves, but some of the people supporting particular contestants were getting really, really nasty and weird and gatekeepy about it in ways mm-hmm. that seem strange to me, since I was the one that actually running it. But they're like people were trying to impose these sort of rules and restrictions on it that had nothing to do with any of our actual intentions, or even the people they were supposed to be supporting. And it seemed like a sign that, you know, it had probably run its course.
Now, was the last one pre-Trump?
Yeah.
Or was it? Okay. Yeah. No, I can't imagine having done
in the
Trump era. That would have been horrific.
No way. Yeah. The last one, I think, was 2015.
Right.
So it was just coming into it. it wouldn't have been doable after that point.
No, I remember in, I think it would have been 2016, where I was sort of, looking forward to it, but also dreading it. And then, finally, I think you posted saying it's not going to happen this year. And I was like, oh, thank God. Right.
Yeah. That was my feeling too, was very like, should I, shouldn't I? I kind of want to, I kind of don't want to. And then I was like, you know what? It's not worth it. And it was, I feel like that was the right call. It was the right time to end it.
Right. No, I mean, it's nice because it sort of has a place in our memories as this chapter in the history of the national security Twitter sphere, and which is, you know, you could argue is sort of related to or an outgrowth of the national security blogosphere and the blogosphere more generally. But one that is now safely within our memories, like yeah. Mad Max or something like
and
that.
And I mean, it was great for the time, like the number of people I know because of it, you know, I every year, like that was my favorite part of it, is that we would take nominations and every year I would find all about these great, interesting, smart people doing really interesting work who I had no idea about. Many of whom I'm still at least Twitter connected with now. And it was, you know, that was honestly the most fun part of it.
Right. Well, wonderful. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm going to heartily encourage everyone to go and take a look at the Children's Illustrated CloudsFits, whether you're simply an enthusiast or whether you are or will at some point be professionally obligated to read Old Dead Carl. There's a lot here in terms of sort of offering a degree of clarity about what CloudsFits meant or may have meant. There's also stuff to chew on, to talk about and think about whether this is the appropriate interpretation of the argument, you know, what relevance this has for the future or for thinking about conflict and war in the future. But it is an absolutely amazing contribution, and I'm glad that I have my copy here with a little hair CloudsFits on the front and everything else that came with the Kickstarter.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Caitlin. And I want to thank all of the LGM listeners for joining us. And the link to the book will be in the original post. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,